"Don't come any closer," Kilolo warned. But before he took action, he climbed down from the frail ramparts and asked Malama what she thought he ought to do. "What do you think is wisest?" Malama, breathing heavily, countered. "I think we must defy them," Kilolo said gravely. "We have started good laws, and we must not surrender them now." "I agree," Malama said. "But I do not want you to get hurt, my dear husband." Kilolo smiled warmly at her use of this unexpected term, for he knew that she had been forbidden by the missionaries to use it in respect to him. "Do you feel better now?" he asked solicitously, as if he were a courtier and not a husband. "I feel very ill, Kilolo. Do you think they will fire the cannon? I should not like to hear the noise of such a great gun." "I think they will fire," Kilolo said. "And then they will be ashamed of themselves, and after a while they will stop." "Do you think they will kill anyone?" Malama asked fearfully. "Yes." "Kilolo, I hope above all else that they do not kill you. There could be no finer husband than you have been to me." The enormous woman tried to find an easy position and then asked, "Did they harm the missionaries?" "I don't know," Kilolo said. "Isn't it strange?" Malama asked. "The little man spends so much time telling us how the Hawaiians ought to behave, but it is always his people who do the wrong things." There was fighting at the gate, and Kilolo was called away to make decisions. He told his men not to fire their few guns, lest a hopeless riot be initiated. But he did encourage them to use poles to push away the ribald attackers, so that from the bay tree, Captain Hawksworth could see through his glass some of his own men from the Carthaginian being knocked off the walls, at which he grew agitated beyond control and personally wheeled the cannon into position, ordering a charge to be fired. The 40-pound ball whistled high through the palm trees near the fort, and he shouted, "Down 20 feet." The next ball crashed into the fort and threw bits of rock high into the air. The third ball struck the gate area and demolished it, so that hundreds of sailors were free to storm inside, where they elbowed Kilolo aside and threatened Malama. "See that missionary house?" Hawksworth shouted, elated at his success with the cannon. "Up there to the left. Smash it." Again the first ball was high, and Hawksworth danced barefooted with excitement as he directed the sights lowered. The fifth shot of the day tore completely through the mission house, as did the sixth and seventh. "By God," the captain screamed, "that'll end the laws." And then, as if he had been struck by some terrible unseen hand, he clasped his breast, cursed at the gunners, and knocked them about like stones in a child's game. "God damn you," he screamed. "What are you doing?" And leaping into the bay, he swam furiously ashore. Dripping wet, he rushed past the breached fort, where sailors were abusing the chief of police and the fat woman, and onto the mission grounds, where the splintered wood from the shattered grass house appalled him. Bursting into the room he had visited only shortly before, he cried in anguish, "Jerusha, are you hurt?" He did not find her, and started looking under the fallen beams, frail bits of wood hauled patiently from the mountains. And then, from the inner room, he heard sounds. And he smashed open the niggardly woven door, and saw Jerusha and her husband praying in the dust of their destroyed home. "Oh, thank God," he yelled with joy, grabbing Jerusha to his bare and salty body. She did not resist, but passively looked at him with horror, which was heightened when she saw that her husband was approaching him with a broken knife. "No," she found strength to scream. "God will do it, Abner." And with relief, such as she had never known before in her life, not even when Abner, alone and sweating, had delivered her first baby, she saw her husband drop his arm. Quickly, Captain Hawksworth wheeled about, saw the knife, and smashed his fist into Abner's pale face. The little man doubled up and flew backwards against the grass wall and through its weakened portion. From inside the room, He could hear his wife struggling with the sea captain. Before he could regain his feet, he heard her screams, and then the captain's cry of rage as she bit into the great salty hand. By the time he could get back into the room, brandishing a club, he saw Hawksworth standing at the front door, what was left of it, sucking his fiercely bitten hand. And then, as if nothing had happened, the huge sea captain said sorrowfully, "It is a dreadful place that your husband has brought you to, Jerusha. When did you last have a new dress?" He started to go, then added, almost in tears, "Why is it that we always meet when you are pregnant? By this goddamn fool." The rioting continued for 3 more days, and girls who had been well along in Jerusha's school, standing midway between the savage and the civilized, reverted to the insane joy of sleeping 6 and 8 and 10 at a time in the hot focussels of the whaling ships. Murphy's grog shop rollicked with songs. Old men who tried to keep sailors out of their homes were beaten up and their daughters taken. And at the palace, tired, bewildered Malama ordered all women to the hills and found it increasingly difficult to breathe. It was on the 3rd day of the riots that she summoned Abner and asked with difficulty, "How did these things happen, my dear teacher?" "We are all animals, Malama," he explained. "Only the laws of God keep us within the confines of decency." "Why have your men not learned those laws?" Malama asked. "Because Lahaina has itself been so long without the law. Wherever there is no law, men think they can do as they will." "If your king knew about these days, the cannon and the burning of the houses, would he apologize?" "He would be humiliated," Abner affirmed. "Why is it that the Americans and the English and the French are so determined that we sell whiskey in our stores and allow our girls to go to their ships?" "It is because Hawaii has not yet established herself as a civilized nation," Abner explained. "Are your men civilizing us?" Malama asked wearily. "By firing the cannon at us?" "I am ashamed for our men," Abner said in despair. This was the moment Malama had been waiting for. And after a long pause, she said softly, "Now we are equal, Makuahale." "In what way?" Abner asked suspiciously. "You have always told me that I could not achieve a state of grace without humility, without admitting to God that I am lost and totally evil. You would not accept me into your church because you claimed I was not humble. Makuahale, I will tell you something. I wasn't humble, and you were right to keep me out of your church. But do you know why I could not be humble?"
"Why?" Abner asked carefully.
"Because you were not humble. Your ways were always right. Mine were always wrong. Your words were always white. Mine were black. You tried to make me speak Hawaiian because you wanted to learn Hawaiian. And I would not beg to join your church because you spoke of humility but knew it not. Today, Makuahale, with the fort destroyed and your home knocked down by your own people, we are equal. I am humble at last. I am unable to act without God's help. And for the first time I see before me a humble man." The great huge woman began to weep, and after a moment she rose painfully to her knees, pushing aside her sorrowful attendants and making a prayer temple of her hands. From that position she said in total contrition, "I am lost, Makuahale, and I beg you to accept me into your church. I am going to die, and I want to speak with God before I do." From the bay tree, some fools were firing the cannon again at the house of a man and wife who would not give them their daughter, and at the western end of town a building was ablaze. There was a dance underway at Murphy's, and 3 of Pupali's daughters were in Captain Hawksworth's cabin. It was under these conditions that Abner said, "We will baptize you into the Church of God, Malama. We will do it on Sunday." "We had better do it now," Malama suggested, and one of the waiting women nodded. So Abner sent for Jerusha, Keoki, Noilani, Kelolo, Captain Janders, and the Whipples. They came through the rioters, who jeered at Janders for not being a real sea captain, and at the Whipples for being missionaries. But when Dr. Whipple saw Malama, he was greatly concerned and said, "This woman is very ill," at which huge Kelolo began to sob. It was a mournful crowd that formed a semicircle around Malama, who lay flat on the floor, wheezing painfully. The cannon sounded in the distance, and half a hundred hoodlums who had trailed the Whipples jeered outside the palace gates. Without a Bible, Abner recited from memory the closing passages of Proverbs, and the words had a special application to Malama, the Eli'inui. "Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness." Then he announced to the gathering, "Malama Kanakoa, daughter of the king of Kona, having entered into a state of grace, seeks baptism into the Holy Church of God. Is it your wish that she be accepted?" Keoki spoke first, then Janders and the Whipples. But when it came time for Jerusha, who in the last days had appreciated for the first time the courage Malama had shown in governing Maui, she did not speak, but bowed down and kissed the sick woman. "You are my daughter," Malama said weakly. Abner interrupted and said, "Malama, you will now put aside your heathen name and take a Christian one. Which do you wish?" A look of supreme joy came over the sick woman's massive face, and she whispered, "I should like the name of that dear friend of whom Jerusha has often told me. My name will be Luca. Jerusha, will you tell me the story for the last time?" And as if she were talking to her own children at dusk, Jerusha began once more the story of Ruth, Luca to the Hawaiians. And when she came to the part about the alien land, she broke down and was unable to continue. So Malama concluded the story, adding, "May I, like Luca, find happiness in the new land to which I shall soon go." After the baptism, Whipple suggested, "You'd better leave now. I have to examine Malama." "I'll die with the old medicines, doctor," Malama said simply, and she indicated to Kelolo that he must now bring in the kahunas. "Are kahunas proper when we have just—" Abner began. But Jerusha pulled him away, and the little procession marched back to the center of town, where Amanda Whipple suggested, "You had better stay with us, Jerusha and Abner." "We will stay in our house," Jerusha said firmly. And when they were there, after the riotings had subsided, and the ship captains were beginning to feel ashamed of themselves, for natives were whispering that sailors at the fort had killed Malama or had caused her near death, Captain Rafer Hawksworth, fully dressed with polished cap and buttons, came up the pathway to the mission house, followed by five sailors with armloads of gifts. Tucking his hat under his arm, as he had long ago been taught to do when addressing a lady, he said gruffly, "I apologize, ma'am. If I have broken anything, I want to replace it. The other captains have contributed these chairs and this table." He paused in some embarrassment and then added, "And I've gone among the ships and got this cloth. I trust you'll make yourself some some new dresses, ma'am." He bowed, placed his hat on his head, and left the mission grounds. At first, Abner was intent upon demolishing the furniture. "We'll burn it on the pier," he threatened. But Jerusha would not permit this. "It has been sent to us as an act of retribution," she said firmly. "We have always needed chairs and a desk." "Do you think that I could translate the Bible On that desk? Abner asked. Captain Huxworth did not send it, Jerusha replied. And while her husband watched, she started arranging the chairs in the damaged room. God has sent these things to the mission, she said, and not to Abner and Jerusha Hale. I'll give the cloth to Malama's women, Abner insisted. And to this Jerusha agreed. But when he was gone, and the town was once more quiet, she sat in one of the new chairs at her new kitchen table and composed this letter. My dearest sister Esther in God, you alone of all the people I know will have the grace to forgive me for what I am about to do. It is an act of vanity, and one, under the circumstances of my life, truly unforgivable. But if it is sinful, it must rest on me alone, and I am powerless to avoid it. Dearest sister, do not smile at me, and above all, tell no one of my vanity. You have often asked me if there might be some small thing that you could send me, and I have always replied that God provided for my dear husband and me, and that is the truth. The mission board has sent us all that we require, but lately, as I grow older, I realize with some dismay that it has been many years since I have worn a dress that was made particularly for me. Quickly, I must add that those which they send us from the charity barrels are good and in fine style, but I find myself desiring just once more a dress of my own. I should like it to be russet in color, with either blue or red trimming, and I would be especially grateful to you if it could have the full round sleeves that seem to be in popular style today. I saw such a dress some years ago on a woman heading for Honolulu, and I thought it very becoming. But if the styles have changed substantially, and if there is now a fashion that I do not know of, I would rather wish you to follow the newer style. Hats I do not need, but if you could find it in your heart to send me a pair of gloves, with lace as in the old days, I should be most deeply appreciative. I do not need to tell you, dearest Esther, that I have no money wherewith to pay you for this extraordinary request, for I have not seen a dollar in over 7 years, and do not require to see any. And I appreciate that this is a vain and costly imposition to place upon a friend, but I pray that you will understand. I am not as stout as I used to be, and seem not to be as tall, so do not make the dress too large. I would judge from what your dear brother tells me that I am now about your size, but I do not want one of your dresses or anybody's. The cloth must be wholly new and mine. And may you find the charity in your heart to forgive me for this begging letter. Your sister, Jerusha. When she went to Janders and Whipple's store to post the letter, she discovered that the Carthaginian had sailed, and that lovely Iliki, Pupali's youngest, had joined the captain. She felt sorrier for this than for anything that had happened in the past days, and she could not refrain from tears. She was an adorable child, Jerusha said mournfully. We shall not find another like her. Already I feel her departure as a great loss, for I had come to think of her as my own daughter. I do hope the world is good to Iliki. And she tried to dry her eyes, but the tears would not cease. One of the last public acts Malama performed was to climb into her land canoe, adjusting herself painfully on piles of tapa, and directing her bearers to carry her through the damaged streets. Wherever she went, she said simply, "The laws we gave are good laws. They must be obeyed." She stopped to encourage policemen, and at Murphy's grog shop again announced in short gasps, "No more alcohol may be sold to Hawaiians. Girls must stop dancing here undressed." And the force of her words, coming as it did so soon after the riots, was 4 times what it had been before. And gradually Kilolo's policemen retrieved the control they had lost, and gained more besides. In her ludicrous canoe, followed by her 2 enormous ladies-in-waiting and the men with feathered staves, Malama became a figure of considerable dignity.
Both Abner and Jerusha noticed that on this strange canoe journey, Malama's children, Keoki and Noelani, were drawn closely to her. And at the fort where the largest congregation had assembled, Malama went so far as to announce, "I am going to die. My daughter Noelani will be the Ali'inui." There was no applause, but the citizens studied the handsome young girl with increased respect. Abner now observed that the important kahunas of the island were gathering about Malama and arguing with her fervently, and he assumed that they were trying to cajole their renegade leader into abandoning her new religion. But this was not the case. The kahunas were satisfied with Christianity and were willing to acknowledge that its God was patently superior to their own. So prudence alone directed them to respect the potent newcomer. But they were also eager to overlook nothing in protecting their calm and massive Ali'i in her last days. So as Abner prayed to Jehovah, they silently prayed to Kane. They massaged Malama with special care, sought traditional herbs to soothe her, and prepared favorite foods, on which she continued to gorge, feeling that only in this way had she any chance of recovering her strength. She ate 4 times a day and sometimes 5, and at a normal meal consumed 1 pound or 2 of roast pig, part of a dog, some baked fish, a substantial helping of breadfruit, and not less than 1 quart of poi, and oftentimes 2 or 3, after which the Lomi Lomi women would knead her stomach to spur her faltering digestion. Dr. Whipple stormed, "She's eating herself to death, but she started doing so when she was 20. Such fantastic meals." When word reached the other islands that Malama, daughter of the king of Kona, was dying, the Ali'i assembled, as they had at deathbeds for untold generations. And in after years, whenever an American who had been in Lahaina at the time was asked for his most vivid impression of the island, he never referred to the cannonading, but to this last mournful gathering of the Ali'i. They came from distant Kauai in ships and from Lanai in canoes. They came singly and in groups. Some came in Western clothes, I recall,